almost 7:30.
And I'm David Alkeck. I'm the president of this august body. And welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Are there any visitors here for the first time? Would you please raise your hand? And how did you hear about us?
On the internet.
On the internet. It's that somebody just wrote you?
It's an automatic email.
Automatic email. Okay, great. Well, welcome, and I hope you learned something. Somebody back here? Yes. How did y'all hear about us?
The internet as well. Yeah, we sort of been listening around.
Uh-huh.
So, Sam Harris' podcast, a few other things, and start digging around on where we can get a little more involved closely ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, website.
Great. Well, you'll find this very, very educational and entertaining, even though it's the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Our speakers aren't always professional academic philosophers. Sometimes they're scientists, and we even had the poet laureate of Oklahoma one time. We have lay people who are interested in philosophy or a related subject to give us talks also. We've had doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and different people to talk to us. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Make sure you do pay your bill and take care of your server. Even if philosophy is not free, we do have our expenses. So if you would see our treasurer and pay for your admission today, if you're a full-time student, it's only $2. Let me see. What else do we have to say? Let me introduce our speaker, Dr. James Beebe, Ph.D., native Texan, born in Belton, grew up there and in Fort Worth, went to Mother Baylor in Waco, got his Ph.D. from St. Louis University. He teaches now at the University of Buffalo, and I asked him, how in the world did you get down here? He said, well, he's got family, still relations down here, and he heard about us, about our group, and that we engage speakers like him, and so actually he reached out to us, somehow he got a hold of you, David?
That's right.
That's great. His main area is in epistemology, and he's working on his book, The Limits of Skepticism. Skepticism does have its limits, I guess. Okay, without any further ado, welcome Dr. Beebe.
Yeah, so it's nice to be here. So I heard about this group. Heard about this group from an SMU professor that had given a lecture here the other a few years ago. Let me know if I need to do anything.
No, you're fine.
Okay. So anyway, I teach courses on critical thinking every semester in Buffalo, and I teach courses on epistemology, as many of you will know, concerning debates within philosophy about what knowledge really is, whether we can really have it, and what makes for rationally justified or unjustified beliefs. So those are my main areas. But I've always had this big interest in psychology and the sciences of the mind generally. And so when this new movement came along, around 15 years ago or so, called experimental philosophy, I said, oh, I'd like to do that. So I jumped on board. And I got a lot of, I'm here to tell you what experimental philosophy is, to see if you might find it interesting and might be interested in doing some more reading about it and learning about it. So I'm going to give an overview as to what it is, how it got started, and what the people who started it have done, its relevance to traditional philosophy. The main idea is that philosophers have become involved in performing scientific experiments and gathering data that's relevant to traditional philosophical debates. And I'm going to talk about how that's, in some sense, not a terribly new thing, but in another sense, is pretty significant. So philosophers over many, many years, centuries, have reflected upon empirical knowledge from the sciences. It's just that they let other people do the science, and then they maybe comment on it or something like that, talk about its philosophical implications, talking about the meaning of contemporary physics or evolutionary biology or psychology or neuroscience or questions about human nature and our place in the world. The main difference is that philosophers like myself have gotten a lot of training in psychology and research methods and statistics and things like that, and collaborated and partnered with either mostly psychologists, though sometimes neuroscientists and experimental economists and others, linguists perhaps, in actually getting involved in the experiments. So I've got some questions I want to talk about. Oh, sorry, wrong button. The questions I want to talk about today: what is experimental philosophy? How is it relevant to traditional debates within philosophy? Some questions, some concerns you might have. Are experiments done by non-scientists, aren't they likely to be bad, poorly done, or something like that? And I'm going to suggest some readings. By the way, is there a way that I could like send these slides to the meetup group somehow? And if you wanted to like look up the books, is there a way to do that?
You can send me your slides, and I'll post them on the website.
Okay, great. That way, I don't know, you see a book or so that I mentioned that sounds interesting, that way you've got the reference. Okay, great. I'll do that. Okay. So those are the questions I want to talk about. So philosophers get involved in gathering scientific data, doing scientific experiments. Before I really sort of talk about experimental philosophy proper, I just want to remind you of many of the ways in which people who do philosophy read science or care about science or empirical knowledge generally. So I sort of want to warm you, for just a second, I want to warm you up to experimental philosophy, if that's okay. So sometimes I get this question like, you're doing these studies, which are basically psychology. I think of experimental philosophy as a philosophically interesting psychology that I do. But people say, well, you're doing that science. That's weird. Philosophers don't have labs. When a philosophy professor gets hired at a university, they don't get a lab. If you hire a chemistry professor, a physics professor, you don't just have to pay their salary and benefits, right? You got to pay for all the lab equipment and the lab rooms. You don't have to do that with philosophers. And so something about experimental philosophy can seem kind of weird. And so I often get questions about, like, I don't even understand how you're putting together philosophy and science. I don't get it. One of the first things I do is I'll just say, have you heard of Daniel Dennett? And many of you will probably have heard of Daniel Dennett. Is that right? If you haven't, that's okay. I'll tell you a little bit about him. But in fact, you could learn about him in a very recent issue of The New Yorker. There's a big profile about him. But he's a guy who put philosophy of mind on the map in the 1970s and 80s. So there's different corners of philosophy. You got logic, you got ethics, and all sorts of different things. And philosophy of mind is just the area concerned with thinking about the human mind, the brain, and things like that. Philosophers have, of course, thought about those things for ages. But Dennett sort of put modern, sort of contemporary, serious philosophy of mind on the map and made it one of the coolest areas to be involved in. A couple of you mentioned, in fact, before dinner, we were talking about a couple of his books on consciousness or just understanding other minds, artificial intelligence. He's also written what is probably the most interesting book about evolution ever written by a philosopher. I'm not sure that could be done. So one of the things, if you haven't heard Daniel Dennett, then maybe my starting point here may not mean as much to you as others, as it might be to some others. But the idea is we have a guy who is clearly a philosopher, and yet is constantly talking about empirical data. In these sort of three books, and many others, this is only a small selection, he's looking at neuroscience, psychology, the decision sciences, economics, evolution, and he's thinking about traditional big idea philosophical questions. And so one of the first things I do is I just want to mention that, he's clearly being a philosopher when he does all this stuff, and so being knee-deep or even higher, more deep, into empirical data sort of doesn't mean you're not doing philosophy. And in fact, as you guys have said when you introduced the group, I mean, how is philosophers formed, right? It involves all sorts of people that aren't professional philosophers. You can talk about big ideas from, you know, no matter what you are, you know, where you are. So these days, if someone wants to be a professional academic philosopher and talk about the mind, they can't say, I don't care what neuroscientists have to say about anything. You just can't do that. So empirical data is going to be relevant. But I also wanted to mention some other areas where knowing some empirical data is relevant. This is all warming you up to experimental philosophy. One of the things that philosophers have done over the centuries is do philosophy of science, where you ask big questions about, so what is science anyway? What distinguishes it from other sorts of activities, from pseudoscience or just non-science? It's not pseudoscience. I mean, what makes something a humanities discipline versus a science or pseudoscience, like astrology or something? So big questions about science follows the philosophy of science, and obviously you've got to know something about the science to do that. One of my great warm-up moves is this. This will be my last one before moving on to actually what more about what experimental philosophy actually is. These days, when someone wants to be in academic philosophy and write books about political philosophy, they have to know a lot of, not about experiments, but they do have to know a lot of empirical knowledge outside of philosophy. You can't just read other philosophers and be a good political philosopher these days. And here's just two great things I want to mention about that. Once upon a time, if you wanted to do political philosophy, what you did was you wrote your utopia, your ideal of the perfect, most wonderful ideal way that a society or political system could be structured. So several of you probably have peeked at least Plato's Republic somewhere along the way, which is the first book in this tradition, and probably the first great work of Western philosophy. But it's just incredibly implausible, and it's utopian. When political philosophers sort of write their utopia, very often it's something that doesn't work for humans like us that are selfish and short-sighted and have limited attention spans, limited cognitive resources, and are prejudiced and uncooperative. Okay. And so these days in political philosophy, you can't just go write your utopian ideal that sort of doesn't apply. Right? It's got to be real and relevant. But in order to do that, you've got to know about sort of actual politics and how it currently runs. So a few years ago, I was at a lunch with some political philosophers. We were having this one prestigious guest in, and then two of my colleagues were along as well. We were all eating lunch, and they were all talking about all this stuff about, well, you know, in Sweden, they have such and such of political arrangement in their laws like this. And someone else will chip in with, oh, well, actually, recently Switzerland just, and, oh, yes, and Norway. And all I had to offer that lunch, by the way, was just something about the pizza. That's all I could comment on. But the other three philosophers there at the table just were constantly talking about current political events and arrangements, right? And so you got to know that to do the philosophy well. Okay. So I'm warming you up. To do philosophy well in a lot of areas, you very often have to know about something else. Okay, that's the warm-up. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some of the people and some of their research who first gave rise to experimental philosophy. And it started in 2001 and 2003. It's not been very old. So remember the big change. So philosophers have always thought about empirical data outside of their field, either for political science or neuroscience or whatever, physics. But around the turn of the century, some decided to sort of get involved in the actual doing of it. Now, so I want to tell you about some of their experiments, some of their studies, some of their motivations as to why they did it. So this guy named Joshua Knobe is the leader of the experimental philosophy movement. He coined the term in its sort of modern usage and has been responsible for giving it the visibility that it's had within the academic world. And it began with a couple of publications that he published in 2003, which I'll tell you about in just a second. Before he ever did that, though, he had gotten like an undergraduate philosophy degree and was just taking a few years off before going on to graduate school in philosophy. He wound up getting a PhD in philosophy from Princeton, but before he did that, he just apprenticed himself to a psychologist at the University of Oregon, and they did some studies together, and Noble learned all these things about statistics that he never learned before, and setting up experiments, and how do you write about them, and he wound up publishing, co-authoring about three papers with this psychology professor, while he's just not a student, just kind of in between stuff. And then he goes on to his PhD in philosophy, and he just thinks, oh, I'm going to leave that psychology behind. Psychology is supposed to be one thing, and we tend to be too rigid in the boundaries that we draw around various disciplines. So he thought he might leave it behind. But when he started doing his philosophy, he began reading these philosophers who were just talking about, so what does it mean to intentionally perform an action? And he read these philosophers who were just having regular old philosophy debates. They weren't doing experiments like experimental philosophers, just regular philosophy debates, the way that, you know, Aristotle argues against Plato, and Kant against Hume, and whatever. Just regular old stuff. But Joshua Noble took a look at some of these definitions of what it means to do something intentionally, and he got some ideas about the old psychology studies that he did, and he thought he could put them together and come up with something interesting. So in the regular philosophical literature, he found that lots of philosophers, academic philosophers, thought to intentionally perform an action was a matter of something like this. To intend or have as your desired goal that a certain something be brought about, and to believe that what you're doing will bring it about. So these are internal mental states, to have an intention or a desired goal, or to believe that something's going to happen. These are all about what's going on in your head. So he noticed that amongst the philosophers that were writing, to intentionally do something, consequences external to you, to your mind, what actually happens out there, actually unfolds in the world, isn't relevant to whether you do it intentionally. And that seems kind of commonsensically to do it this way. But Josh had some ideas about how that wasn't maybe quite right. So here's what he did. He performed an experiment involving he took a thought experiment, which is very common throughout philosophy. Before we get to that, just let me remind you that throughout the history of philosophy, philosophers have told various tales to sort of get you thinking. I mentioned Plato's Republic a minute ago. There's this super interesting story of the Ring of Gyges in Plato's Republic. You might take a look at it sometime if you haven't read it. It's told by Plato's brother. Within the Republic, it's Plato's brother named Glaucon, and it's supposed this guy has this magic ring, and it makes him invisible, and he can sort of rape and pillage and steal, would he have any motivation to sort of do the right and morally virtuous thing if the ring was so cool and so powerful that he could never get caught? And so you see, and then of course many of you will be familiar with René Descartes in the early 17th century, his discussion of, suppose there were this all-powerful being, super powerful like God, but not nice like God's supposed to be, and is out to deceive you, and could you ever know that you're not being deceived? All I want to do is note is that sort of tales like this, thought experiments, we generally call them, not the only thing philosophers do, but it's one of them, you know. John Snow wanted to use something like that. Give someone a story, then ask them the key question at the end and see how they responded, but sort of maybe gather data about how different people responded to the thought experiment, where you sort of, so there you go, so it looks like this. Here's the story. The vice president of a company went to the chairman of the board and said, we're thinking of starting a new program, and we are sure that it's going to increase profits. And then the story splits off into two different versions, and each person who's given the story only gets one version, by the way. So some people get the version that says, we're sure that it will increase profits, but it will also harm the environment. Well, another group gets the story, we're sure that it will increase profits, and it will help the environment. Both versions of the story continue with the chairman saying, look, I don't care about the environment, the helping or the harming, whatever that is, I don't care. I just care about the money, the profit. Let's start the new program. They started it. Sure enough, the environment, the story ends. Sure enough, the environment was helped, if that's the version they got. Or the people who got the other version of the story about harm ends with sure enough, it was harm. And in both, no matter who gets the story, though, Josh Nova asked people, did the chairman intentionally harm the environment? Or in the other version, did he intentionally help it? And here's what he found. People who got the help version they're going to start the new program, it's going to increase profits, and it's going to help. Did he intentionally help? They say only 23% of the time said yes, and the rest said no. Now, when the environment is harmed, he asks, did he intentionally harm? And 82% say yes, and this is a huge difference. He just asked them to answer yes or no. There's other answer choices you can give in a questionnaire. But in his, it was just a yes or a no. And you can see it's a very big difference, and it's been replicated in a variety of times. Now, the reason why this helped against, give some life to this experimental philosophy movement is, I mentioned a minute ago that amongst regular philosophers, they were assuming, just, I think, rather commonsensically, that to do something intentionally is a matter of what's in your mind, and it doesn't matter what's going on out there. Like, it has to do with, what's my goal, and what's my belief, what's going on in here. But it seems like people are actually very much swayed by actually what's going on outside your mind. And this caught philosophers by surprise. They wouldn't predict this data. So that's one strand of research that helped get things going. Got a question about it? No.
Well, wouldn't they just be projecting? Like, if they would...
Maybe.
Yes.
But why, when you project into different one version of the story rather than another, why would you wind up with a different version?
Because 82% would rather harm it. Or, I don't know. I was just questioning.
We're just naturally negative.
I don't know.
I would think
maybe
you would find that problem.
Maybe.
We're going to have some Q&A and answers.
Sorry. Let's finish.
I was just... It's okay. That's all right. He had such a puzzled look on his face, I couldn't just really put it there. That face. Okay, so we can come back to questions. In any case, the main idea behind Josh's original research, he's gone on to do all sorts of other things. But it's just that we have an existing philosophical debate, and he went out and gathered some data that's relevant to it, and the data wound up being not what the philosophers would have predicted, and it gives them something sort of interesting to think about. We're going to talk about some other areas. Some other people who helped give birth to experimental philosophy is this team. Stephen Stitch is a philosophy professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And these are two of his former students, Sean Nichols and Jonathan Weinberg, who are now in Arizona. And their early research was based on thought experiments as well. So in epistemology in particular. So it's a lot of epistemology. We imagine to ourselves, okay, somebody has such and such a belief, and the person has this evidence, and it does actually wind up that reality really is like their belief was. And so we ask, was it rational for them to have had that belief? Or did they really know it, or sort of just accidentally happen upon the truth? We go through thought experiments a lot like this in epistemology. And what Weinberg, Nichols, and Stitch wanted to do is look at a kind of case that had been debated about, been debated by some 20th century philosophers beginning in the 1960s, and it goes like this. So, Bob has this friend who's driven a Buick for many years, and Bob thinks that Jill drives an American car. Now, he's not aware that her Buick has recently been stolen. He's also not aware that Jill has replaced it with a Pontiac, which is a different kind of American car. They don't make those anymore. Okay, this is a study that was done back when, of course, when they still made them. Well, there's different versions of this, but in any case, beginning in the first great work in the West on epistemology, by Plato, called in a dialogue called the Theaetetus, Plato, at the end of the dialogue defines knowledge as justified true belief. In order to know, you got to believe it. Wouldn't make any sense to say you know if someone asks you whether you have an opinion or belief on the matter, and you're like, I don't have any belief whatsoever, no opinion. That would be odd to say that in that situation you know. So Plato thought, well, you got to believe it, and it's got to be an accurate belief. Your belief has got to match. You know, if you believe it's Wednesday, and it's Wednesday, good. You believe it's Wednesday, and it's Thursday, okay, not good. There's got to be a match between your belief and reality. And then finally, Plato says you've got to be justified. You've got to have a reason. So Plato thought there were sort of three conditions for knowledge. It's got to be a justified, true belief. Well, it seems like, by the way, in this case, that Bob's got a justified, true belief. So what's Bob's belief? Jill drives an American car. Is it true? Yeah, she does. Now, is he justified in that belief? Yeah, he's seen her drive an American car for all those years. She's got a justified jubilee. But of course, there's some funny business in the story, right? It's true for one reason, which is different from the reason that justifies him. Like, he's justified because he's seen her drive the Buick all those years. But it's a true belief because she owns the Pontiac. So there's kind of, there's a mismatch between what makes it justified and what makes it true. So we still have to justify true beliefs, but beginning in the 60s, some philosophers began debating like this, cases like this, and they said it may be a justified true belief, but it's not knowledge. Does Bob know, does he really know that she drives an American car? Most epistemologists in America and the UK said no. So that shows that Plato needs updating, they thought. Plato thought justified true belief, we got a guy with a justified true belief, but it doesn't look like knowledge, so knowledge can't just be that fine. So there's been this debate about how do you define knowledge? Does it even have a definition? Plato offered one. Well, what Andre Nicholson Stitch did is they just took this thought experiment and a bunch of others. I'm just showing you one from them, but they took a whole bunch of, more than a dozen, to all sorts of people who are not philosophers, and they asked him, okay, does Bob know? Does he really know? Or does it just, is it a merely belief? No, I mean, you can lucky guesses can wind up to be true, but it doesn't mean you knew the lucky guess was going to wind up to be, right? So not every belief, if it's true, is going to be knowledge. So here's what Weinberg, Nicholson, Stitch found. They found some demographic differences initially. For purposes of their study, what they mean is Americans, and their participants are actually all college students, American college students of Western European ancestry gave the verdict which American philosophers think is the right one. That's not knowledge. It's a belief that happened to be right, but it did not really know. But amongst people from China, Japan, or Korea, or India, they weren't so convinced that this was not knowledge. We have a slight majority here on the side of that it is knowledge, really. So these were all people who are perfectly fluent in English. They're attending American universities, courses taught in English. In any case, so the first thing they noticed was, so they did their analysis and they noticed there's some differences between how these different demographic groups sort of responded to the epistemological case, the thought experiment that concerns knowledge in some respects. And this helps to give birth to a lot of experimental philosophy because what you find is, you'll find a philosopher sort of writing and they're thinking to themselves, surely everybody's going to agree with my verdict about the case, sort of not, and far too often you'll see philosophers sort of not really noticing that, you know, there are people who are different from you. I mean, the discipline of academic philosophy is, we're the most male-dominated discipline in all the humanities, so more than history or English or foreign languages. So we're more white, we're more male, more higher socioeconomic status than the sort of average population. And so if the epistemologists just talk only amongst themselves and ask themselves, what do we think? Well, what they think actually may not match the rest of the world. So one motivation for doing experimental philosophy with these guys, Weinberg, Nicholson, Stitch, is they just said, well, let's just go ask other people and see. Are professional philosophers operating with unique concepts that are different from the rest, or do they match, or what? So, and of course, if we were to get people some cases, some thought experiments, and we find sort of worldwide agreement about them, that might actually make the argument, the philosophical that you want to base on that thought experiment more strong. Okay. Let me mention one more strand of investigation that helped give rise to experimental philosophy. And here I'm going to go into a bit more detail. The previous couple of ones, the one about the chairman and then the one about the car, I was just mentioning this. These were just the first articles published around 2001 and 2003 that helped get experimental philosophy going. I want to go in a bit more in depth here. Not be quite so surfacey. Give you more data, more about the studies. So, philosophers have debated ethics from the very beginning. So the very first philosopher in the West is Socrates. I don't think if you're ever heard of the pre-Socratic philosophers. I don't think those, anybody heard of pre-Socratic philosophers? I don't think those guys were actually philosophers. They're just physical scientists. They offered theories like, how many elements are there? The periodic table of elements of ancient Greece had four things on it, earth, air, fire, and water. And some of the pre-Socratic philosophers said, maybe we could just reduce the four elements to one fundamental thing, or something like that. I think they were doing physics, chemistry. I don't think they're really philosophers. So it might be the first real philosopher we have is Socrates. And he's totally concerned, overwhelmingly concerned with ethical matters. What is virtue? How do you acquire it? How do you know when you got it? All sorts of, what are the individual virtues really consistent? What is piety? What is justice? And so on like that. So, concern with ethics has been a Western philosophy from the very beginning, and Eastern philosophy as well. The most influential Chinese philosopher is Confucius, and his writings are almost totally about ethics as well. Now, some of the time when philosophers go to talk about ethics, they'll talk about how the average person thinks about ethics. Now, there's going to be a distinction here between how do ordinary folks actually think about ethics, and then how should they think about ethics. And most of the time when a philosopher is writing a philosophy book, they're talking about how people should think about ethics. Most of the time, that's the focus. But along the way, they make comments and assumptions about how the average person does think about ethics. So the received wisdom in philosophy has been for a very long time that the average person everywhere in every culture in every century endorses a view that's called moral objectivism. So it's the view that moral judgments are really true or false, as opposed to occasionally throughout the history of philosophical ethics, you see people say, when I say stealing is wrong, what I'm really saying is stealing, ooh. When I say you should keep your promises, what I'm really saying is promise keeping, yay. I'm just sort of expressing emotions. So when I say yay, I didn't say anything true or false. I mean, you're learning something about me when I say yay or when I say boo. You're learning about, I don't know, where my sentiments lie. You know, yay for Ronaldo, no, boo for Ronaldo, yay for Messi. You learn something about, okay. But it's not because I said something true or false when I said yay or boo are not true or false. Okay. So there have been people who have objected to this, philosophers who have objected to this line. But the received wisdom in philosophy is supposed to be that the average person thinks, no, when I say stealing is wrong, that's, I'm taking myself to be stating a fact, just as if I said the atomic number of gold is 79. I mean, I'm stating it's a plain old fact. And just like facts about the atomic number of gold, whether it's true or false is completely independent of culture, it's completely independent of subjective desires, anything subjective, it's just a fact. The price of gold is a subjective matter, right? The price of gold depends upon how much we desire it, prefer it to other metals. But the atomic number of gold, that's not a subjective matter, right? It's either got that number of protons in the nucleus or not. Right? So the thought is, philosophers have for a long time assumed that everybody everywhere believes this about morality. But the thing is that they never actually asked everybody everywhere. Right. So you see how experimental philosophy comes in? We just go and... So all experimental philosophy is we just go and ask. That's not all we do, but I mean that's a key motivation for it. One of the most common ways that you can reject or object to moral objectivism is by being a relativist. There are actually other ways. I actually mentioned one other way. Remember the yay or boo thing? That's called emotivism. Some of you may have heard of that as a philosophical theory. I only gave you the most simple-minded, simplistic version of emotivism. There's much more sophisticated ones than the boo yay version. But the boo yay emotivism is opposed to objectivism. But another way to be opposed to it is to say that morality is relative culture to culture. Sometimes you see it, morality being relative from person to person, but I feel like the cultural variety is the most common variety, I think. But that's different than objectivism, because objectivism says there's just one set of moral rules, and it's just sort of, they're like timeless, eternal truths. They're not sort of indexed to this group of folks at this time, or this other group of folks at this other time. It's just true across the board. Okay, so... I've got actually here a slide somewhere. I guess I actually really took it out. These guys. I just mentioned a few sort of key books in ethics over the last, you know, few decades. Again, you'll have these slides if you want to sort of take a peek at any of this stuff. I don't know. We have some sort of leading academic philosophers that write about ethics, and that's just a small sampling. But they all endorse the view that I mentioned a moment ago. They think that the average person everywhere believes in moral objectivism. Only confused first semester freshmen are relativists. They really believe that. I think they're mistaken. But they think they think that the first semester freshman isn't even really a relativist. The freshman who says, well, that may be right for them over there or way back then, but it's not right for us today. All of these people, and most every philosophy professor, probably at SMU and TCU and then everywhere else in the neighborhood, probably thinks that if you just talk with that confused first semester freshman for a little while, you'll get them to see that they're not really a relativist after all. They're just temporarily confused. I think that's false. In any case, this has been the received view. So what's happened is, I performed some studies, or just asking the average person, what do you think about these matters? And some of my friends have as well, so I'm going to start with what some of my friends have done here. And we find a very different view from what the philosophers might have assumed. So here's a study done by Joshua Nunn that I mentioned earlier, and a friend of mine, Hagop Sarkissian, and a few others. He starts off with a little backstory. In the picture, this picture actually appears in the study. This is Sam. The whole description is supposed to give you the idea that Sam's a regular guy, just like you and my friend Hagop. He teaches at Baruch College in New York City, and so he's giving the study, by the way, to students at Baruch. Okay, so Sam's a regular guy. His parents come from Poughkeepsie. That's just outside of New York City. It's an all-American town. He enjoys going to the beach watching football, college football. He plans to go traveling for a while after graduation. Management consulting. We have a management consultant somewhere around here. I forget who that was. Now, Sam has very different moral views than most of his fellow students, okay? He's a regular guy. All right. Now, then the next thing that my friend Hagop did is, he suspected that we're going to find moral relativism among lots of people. It's not just going to be confused freshmen. He started out with Baruch College students, but he went far beyond that eventually. He expected we're going to find some moral relativism. And he didn't want to start with a case where it would be expected to find moral relativism. So it's easy to be a moral relativist if there's no blood, suffering, death, pain, misery. As long as no one's being hurt, it's much easier to say, oh, well, if that's the way they do things over there, then maybe that's right for them, may not be right for us. But as soon as you start slicing people up, I don't know, you might not find relativism, right? It's harder to say, right? The people are getting sliced. It's harder to say, well, that's fine for them, right? See how that works? So he came up with two cases where surely you would really expect to not find relativism. And he's going to find it anyway. So one is this. How about a case of where a guy kills his youngest child just because he's unattractive? I mean, there's no good reason. Wouldn't most all of us kill under the right circumstances? Self-defense, defending your family, defending whatever, I don't know, something? Maybe. Okay, you're not naughty, but I would. I mean, you don't have to be worried about me, but given the right circumstances, you know, killing to stop Hitler? I mean, right, wouldn't we do something like that? Okay. But he wanted a case of nothing like that, nothing like in the name of something noble and, you know, not just, it's a terrible reason, right? Okay. And he included another picture of another student. So we have two students, classmates, just like you, New York City college students. One of your classmates hears about this, thinks it's morally wrong. Sam hears about it. He's a regular guy, but he does have unusual views. He thinks it's okay. Now, this is kind of a long-winded question, but here's the question. Given that these individuals have different judgments about the case, we'd like to know whether you think that at least one of them must be wrong, or do you think that both of them could actually be correct? So, to what extent do you disagree or agree with this? Since your classmate and Sam have different judgments about the case, at least one of them must be wrong. So this at least one of them must be wrong bit is going to be a measure of objectivism. So, if I say dark chocolate's better than milk chocolate, Skip says milk chocolate's better than dark chocolate, does one of us have to be wrong? I mean, no, right? Did I say that right? Did I get the milk and the dark the right way? Okay. Because it's a subjective thing. I'm just expressing my subjective preference, and right? He's expressing his. And so it's not true that someone's got to be wrong. I mentioned the atomic number of gold. I'm going to go, I think it's 79, though. I have to go. I'm not going to bet the farm on it. But I think it's 79. You think it's 78. Could we both be right? That makes no... I mean, no. You don't understand the question if you think we could both be right. Right. Atomic number is how many protons are in the nucleus. It's either one or it's the other. Right? You got that? So you see how the question about does somebody have to be wrong in this disagreement case is a measure of the degree in which people think there's an objective fact there, a hard fact, or is it more of a subjective, squishy thing? So first of all, he asked about, we're just comparing two people who are disagreeing that are both sort of regular college folks. Okay, well, how about this? He then introduces someone from a different culture, and he includes this picture. Okay, so the mamelon, this is just made up term. I don't know where the picture came from, but the term, the description is just made up. The mamelons are an isolated tribe of people living in the Amazonian rainforest. The surrounding forest is controlled by a more advanced civilization. The mamelons have struggled to hold on to their traditional culture. Now, the most important of these rituals is a coming-of-age ceremony. It takes place when children reach the age of 14. At that age, children face a choice between leaving the tribe to go to surrounding civilization or swearing a solemn vow to uphold the traditions of this kind of warrior culture. And we can kind of skip the rest. Okay, but you get the idea. It's a very different place. We're not talking about New York City College here, right? That's the main idea. And it's a kind of a long description, which some of which I skipped, but the idea is to really sort of get your mind, get it really sunk into your mind that we're not dealing with the New York City College here. Okay, so to a completely different, one group of people saw the two regular folks from Poughkeepsie disagreeing, completely different group of participants in this part of the study read about the mamelons, the hypothetical people, and one of your college classmates. So one of your classmates hears about this sort of terrible instance, and they think it's wrong, obviously. But now suppose the mamelon hears about it and thinks it's okay. And we ask you that same question. Remember, the same question was, since there's two people, it's not Sam, it's your classmate and the mamelon have different views about this, does at least one of them have to be wrong? And he also threw in an alien culture, but for the sake of time, I'll throw in the alien culture, which is even further far removed from us than the mamelon Amazonian rainforest culture. And here's what he found. How often do people agree or disagree that somebody, of two disagreeing parties, somebody's got to be wrong? So how often do people give that answer? If two people are disagreeing, how often does somebody got to be wrong? Okay, well, let's from this. This is disagree, strongly disagree, and this is strongly agree. So if we've got people from the same culture, and they're disagreeing about inflicting unwanted harm and death, yeah, there's a fact. So the high bar means there's a lot of people saying, somebody's got to be wrong, meaning there's an objective fact here. Okay, but now you make it about the two, now you make the two disagreeing parties, a New York college student and the Amazon warrior guy, or a New York college student and someone who's the alien, who's even further removed, you see that people are less and less confident that there's really a fact there. Does that make sense? So the decreasing bar just means there's fewer times people are saying, yeah, of two disagreeing parties, somebody's got to be wrong because it's a fact, an objective fact. So what they found is, even when there's inflicting pain for not really, I mean, this is not a good reason, unattractive. And then he used another case, too. It also involves a knife. Someone has got a new knife, and they just want to test it. How sharp it is. I've got a new knife. I want to test it. And so they just find a random person. Again, there's no... Surely we're all on the same page and thinking there's not any good reason of any kind for doing that, right? But if the person's from another culture and you make the culture more and more distant from your own, people actually do endorse something like a moral relativism. So what these guys found is that some of the time we sound like there's an objective fact when we're dealing with people that are a lot like us, but some of the time we sound like relatives. So it's not as if we're always one, maybe, or always the other. It depends on some to some extent. And here's some studies that I did as well. This is I'll tell you what this slide means in a moment. What I did is I just looked at, this is a slide from Americans. This is about 2,500 people, from 2,500 people in the Buffalo, New York region. But I also replicated this in China and Poland and Ecuador as well. But what I did is I took people from one culture and I did the same kind of thing that Hagop did. I had two people disagree about something. And I asked this key question. Is this disagreement the kind of aggressive disagreement that's more... Is it the one where somebody's got to be wrong because there's a fact there? Or is it more like the milk chocolate, you know, dark chocolate, where it's, you know, it's all subjective, so we could both be right or something like that? And what I found is I kept the culture constant, so I didn't use, you know, faraway cultures. This is all about Americans' disagreement. And the y-axis is supposed to be how often do people say of two disagreeing parties, somebody's got to be wrong because it seems like there's a factor. Okay, so that's what the y-axis means. The higher it is, the more often someone says somebody's got to be wrong. And let me tell you what the different bits are arranged left to right. So way over here to the right, I had something about discriminating against someone on the basis of race. Is wrong. Is there a fact there about the wrongness of racism? I got the strongest yes answer. Yes, there's a fact there. And similarly for hitting someone without a very good reason or robbing. This was a disagreement about robbing a bank to sort of pay for just selfish things, a yacht and a vacation, you know. With these sorts of things, people are like, yeah, there's a fact about whether it's right or wrong. But far over here to the left, we have some things, some issues that have been debated within our society, like the moral rightness or wrongness of abortion. I did this study some years ago when we still talked a bit more about stem cells than we seem to today. This is about, is it okay to use embryonic stem cells in scientific research? The reason why that was controversial when we talked about it more in our culture was that it does involve the killing of an embryo like abortion. So if you think abortion is wrong, then you would be... Okay, I've forgotten all the details about that. I'm sorry about that. But euthanasia, how about if you help someone die? This is, one person thinks that helping a friend die who's got a terminal illness is very painful, they know it's not going to get better, and is it morally okay for them to die? And we have two people disagree about that. One says, yes, it's okay. Another says, it's not okay. But these issues over here are not settled in society in the way that these things seem to be. So when issues are settled in society, people sound like moral objectivists, like there's a fact there, like this is definitely right, definitely wrong, it's just facts here. But the more controversial you make something, they're not so sure. So I did actually ask these people as part of the study, how controversial, by the way, do you think abortion is in American society versus how controversial do you think these other things are? And I found that how controversial in society they think it is a big predictor as to whether they're going to give the answer, somebody's got to be wrong because there's an objective fact. So the more controversial they see it is, the less likely they are to say that, yes, there's an objective fact. Okay. A little bit more about this research, and we'll talk about some of this upshot. I guess one more thing I will tell you about, I did find an age effect. People are more likely to think that, I found an age effect in the United States, Poland, Ecuador and China, in each of these societies, that the older you are, the more likely you are to think that there are facts about morality. It's not just up for grabs, whatever you feel like. This is all It's only four cultures, and there's many more kinds of cultures out there. I didn't study, of course. But I think it's pretty significant that I found it in these cultures. Okay, now, so let's talk about this last bit of research that I went into a little bit more detail than some of the surfacey bit about the chairman and the environment and the car case. Here we've been talking for a few minutes. I've been talking for a few minutes about moral objectivism. These philosophers and many others, when they go to write about ethics, their starting background assumption is that the average person everywhere, China, anywhere, America, whatever, fully endorses moral objectivism about every issue. And that seems to be just straightforwardly false. Some issues, yes, the ones that are settled in society, yeah. The ones that are less settled in society, not so much, maybe. And with Hagop Sarkissian and the Manilon people, his study, that showed that even about the very same issue, we may talk some of the time like there's an objective fact when we're making one kind of comparison within our own culture. But once we start comparing the views of our culture to some faraway culture, we might actually start sounding like relativists about the very same issue. So in any case, when philosophers, these kinds of studies where we go and ask lots of ordinary folks all over the place, it's not going to solve the age-old philosophical question about whether you should be a relativist or not. It's not aimed at that. It's not supposed to be a replacement for just good old philosophical debate where we go back and forth and we debate. Is relativism a really good idea? Because if you're a relativist, it has its consequences. And are you sure you want to go with those consequences? You know, we should have regular old philosophical debate. Not supposed to be a replacement. But if your whole debate is premised on sort of false assumptions, then how you frame the debate, the directions that you go, the arguments that you offer are going to be very different. And so all the terminal philosophy is doing is sort of providing experiments that will hopefully make the debate better because we have better assumptions. Also, here's one other way that we can contribute to the debate. Well, this particular guy argues, I think it's horrible, so he argues like this. He says, I defend moral objectivism. He calls it moral realism in his book, but it's the idea that there's objective facts about morality. Here's what he says. I'm not actually going to argue in favor of my view because I don't need to. My view is the common sense view. I mean, everybody, it's the common sense amongst every person in every culture everywhere, common sense view. And because I've got common sense on my side, I actually don't need to argue in favor of my view. So all I'm going to do in my book is I'm going to try to poke holes in other guys' views, other people's views who offer different theories. And if I poke holes in their views, even though I've offered no reason for actually thinking that I'm right, I win. I think that's a bad way of arguing in general. Regardless of whether it's experimental philosophy or anything else, you just shouldn't do that. He's trying to do this burden of proof thing, you know, where he said, you guys have the burden of proof. I'm common sense. I don't have to lift a finger. Okay. So a lot of people like myself and others have complained about that strategy. That doesn't sound very good. But once we can show with empirical data that he's just wrong about what, that he's on the side of common sense, he doesn't even know what common sense morality is. He's never asked the common person. He's just assuming, right? From the armchair. In any case, we can sort of, with some empirical data, we can sort of, I think, move that argument move the strategy to the side. So the idea is, so experimental philosophy is where you look at the difference between this and psychology. That was Bob, right? That's his name, right? Bob? That was Bob. Bob asked earlier, how is this different than psychology? Well, everything I've shown you is really psychology. But it's psychology that's led by philosophers, and they're starting from a philosophical debate. They're sort of looking at what philosophers are debating about and thinking, you know, it would be really nice if we had some data on this or that, and then we could inject it back into the debate, not to sort of totally solve everything, maybe, but maybe make it better. And the thing that's new about experimental philosophy is there's a variety of people that have looked at scientific data over the years and talked about its philosophical implications. But if the philosophers aren't involved in the experiments or the studies themselves, then you just have to sit and cross your fingers and hope that they're going to do something that's relevant to what you'd like them to work on. And you may be waiting a while. Maybe they'll get around to working on the very topic that you would really like to see data on. And then good for you. That's great. But maybe they won't get around to it, because maybe the people who are empirical scientists just have other concerns. So the thing that's new about experimental philosophy is we don't sort of, if you have a philosophical debate and you sort of would like to have input on it, then, well, you just go ahead. I think it's one last point, and I'll be done, and that is, not everybody that's doing experimental philosophy is a philosopher, so this is very collaborative. I run the nation's only annual experimental philosophy conference, and our next keynote speaker is a psychology professor. But a lot of the people who are in experimental philosophy that aren't philosophy professors are like her. She's like a psychology and philosophy double majors and undergraduate. Then went on to get her PhD in psychology, but never forgot about all that cool philosophy that she read. So now when she's as a psychologist doing experiments, she's like, oh, I could bring up that old philosophy. And now there's all these philosophers interested in it, we can sort of join together. So one thing about there's a question that I raised earlier. Does experimental philosophy mean that there's non-scientists doing scientists, and isn't that a bad thing? Well, part of it, one way to alleviate that worry is we really do have a lot of scientists on board, and a lot of times, more often than not, papers in experimental philosophy are co-authored. So you'll have the person who's the philosopher, maybe, and the expert about the philosophy bit, and then you'll have other people on board as co-authors, who are either psychologists themselves or people like me who have just gone out and got lots of training in psychology. We really know this is a significant thing. So we sort of make sure our bases are all covered that way. So that may not be a huge concern you had. And anyway, but in the slides that I'll give you, I just mentioned, if you ever want to read more about it, here's some places to start. There's one sort of nice booklet introduction to what is experimental philosophy. Early papers that helped to found the movement were collected in two collected volumes here. You might not want to read those, but this one has a very nice introduction where they sort of, Joshua Knope and someone else sort of just lay out a vision of what is this thing supposed to be, and so she could, at the very least, just read that introductory chapter for a little bit more information about what it is. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. And now we're going to have a little opportunity to ask our speakers some questions.
Yeah. And just a minute. keep your comments succinct. Don't get into a long, rambling lecture. Make it a question, please. And so first, Skip.
I first need to defend my character, Dark Chocolate is Clarity Spirit. Is this, you called it experimental philosophy, it seems more like democratic philosophy the way you described it.
So I don't think it is. So that's good. Good question. So democratic philosophy would be taking a vote about what people think about stuff and using that to determine what's the answer. You didn't say the following, but here's an example. You ask a bunch of people whether humans have free will or not, and if most of them say yes, well, then I guess we do. Philosophical problem solved. We're not actually doing that. Only some of the time are the opinions of the general public going to matter to the philosophical issue. But at no point are we really trying to solve it like that. Like, free will, yes or no, and most everybody, 85%, say yes, that's close enough, so yeah. And we're not actually trying to do that. It's just that in those bits of philosophy where it's relevant to know what they're saying, let's go out and find out what they people, how people think and act and talk. And I think that's the main thing I would say here like that. Here's one brief example. There's a slide that I did skip earlier. In epistemology, for whatever reason, this is just a contingent matter. In the 20th century, especially the second half of the 20th century, amongst professional philosophers that are writing about knowledge, they just became really focused on this question. What is the ordinary concept of knowledge? It's a contingent matter that the second half of the 20th century epistemology went that way. But it sounds to me like what they're really interested in is maybe the answer to the democratic philosophy question. So if you read the way Epistemologists wrote, what is the shared concept amongst the general public at large most everywhere? They're wanting to know the democratic answer. I don't think that's what epistemologists have always done, so I include them here in Descartes. So Descartes in 1641 says, I think therefore I am, and a few other things, and at no point does I think he give a, at no point does he give a rip what the average person in France at the time thought about knowledge. I don't think he gave a rip about that. That's just not what he's doing. He's asking this question, how should we think? Not how do we think, how should we think? That's a different question. And how should we think about the highest, best, most worthy kind of knowledge? Now, you can tell for this project, it doesn't, we don't need to go out and ask people on the street anything. But if we're interested in this, then maybe we do need to get some of the democratic flavor in there. So it's only some of the time for some concerns that we might be interested in the democratic question. So that's enough of an answer, I suppose. Yeah, go ahead.
I heard a speaker the other day from South Africa relate that, I don't know if he saw this or he heard it, but four guys raped a three-year-old girl and then set her on fire when she was still alive. And he said this happens thousands of times. Is there any way that experimental philosophy could justify that behavior?
I don't think so. So experimental philosophy, just the experiment part, is just going to be about gathering data of some sense. And so, you know, all day on the experimental side, the thing we could do is just sort of confirm that, as I suspect, surely, most everybody, most everywhere is going to say that's a horrible thing to do. But that doesn't solve the really philosophical, the big question, the moral question. Because even if everybody did agree, that was a bad thing. I still think we can ask, does everybody have the right opinion? I think they do have the right opinion, but thinking that's terrible. But just the mere fact that everybody agrees doesn't sort of solve everything. I mean, you go back far, you don't have to go back terribly far, and let's see. You go back far enough, and you know, you'll find people thinking that slavery is perfectly fine, treating women as property is perfectly fine. And even if you could find at some given time around the globe, everybody thought treating women like dirt is fine, I'm not sure that you could really find an actual time. But suppose, hypothetically, there were a time where everybody thinks treating women like dirt is fine. Would that show that it's fine? And I think it wouldn't. So even if you gather data showing everybody's in agreement, we still have the core philosophical ethical question left over about how good or bad is it. So anyway, so the idea is there's no way that experimental philosophy can justify that, I suppose. So, yes?
You know, philosophy is love of knowledge, yeah. Love of... philosophy was all kinds of knowledge. Little by little, different disciplines got separated from
right.
it. You know, physics and biology
yeah.
and psychology, right. political science,
yeah.
sociology, and epistemology is really not only psychology, but maybe neurophysiology. How do we know what we know? So is experimental philosophy a way to get back
yeah.
into science?
Absolutely. I think that's a great thing about it is... Yeah, I mean, we have a... Many of you will know that before the word physics came to describe what we think of as physics, that was most commonly called natural philosophy. I think, I'm not totally sure, but I thought that's what Isaac Newton called the thing that he was doing. He didn't call it physics, it's called natural philosophy. And in all sorts of other disciplines, like we're sort of more more of a unit. And I think that's a great thing about interdisciplinary research like that. I totally agree with what you say. I was saying before dinner, talking with someone, I forget who, and we're talking about how the political scientists are over here in their building, and then the sociologists over here in their building, and someone else over here in their building, and we don't talk to each other. You only see the people. You don't even see the people in your own, within your building. You only see the people on your corner of your floor of your building, and you only talk to them. And the great thing about an interdisciplinary research is we're bringing together all sorts of things, and so I think that's a great thing. It's really people don't realize how really artificial it is to divide knowledge up into these separate branches. It really does belong together. So, yeah.
more of an open-ended question, but it seems in asking these questions, a lot of times, particularly between cultures where it's where the language is different, but even even within a culture, language can be very different. I guess my question is, how do you deal with the language problems? Because that's often the basis for disagreement is just the language.
That's a great question. So one key is, to use lots and lots of different experimental materials. There is this research, Weinberg, Nichols, and Stitch are the ones who found the cross-cultural differences between, like, the East Asians and the South Asians didn't maybe think had the same view of this Bob really knows that you're wrong with the American card. Actually, a bunch of problems have been raised for their research for a few reasons. Problems haven't been raised for the other research I talked about. But for theirs, part of it is they use smaller sample sizes than they use. And they use fewer thought experiments and questionnaires. The thing that most relates to yours is that I think we should use lots of different thought experiments and ask people lots of different questions. Instead of just one moneymaker question, a bunch of different questions. If you're going to ask people a bunch of different questions, you often, by the way, need to instead of ask them to freely participate in your study, you need to pay them to give them the motivation to actually pay attention. But you ask them a bunch of different questions with the different wordings, and you see how things turn out. And I think one reason why, in addition to the small sample size thing, is one other thing that creates some problems for them is they just used one wording and thought everything was perfectly fine. And the question of different wordings maybe affecting the answer didn't occur to them. But in all the other research that I've mentioned, we use different wordings to make sure. So the main way I think it can just be done with more thoroughness a lot of times. Now, not always. The cross-cultural issue is different. It's a big issue here. So in Chinese, for example, and I don't know enough about Japanese or Korean, some other Asian languages to know as well, but there aren't articles. You don't say either the dog or a dog. You just say dog. And context is supposed to sort of suggest what you meant, the or a. But the or a are very different. The means there's just one specific one you had in mind, but a dog means there's at least one, and it could be, it's less determined which one you're talking about. And sometimes thought experiments do depend upon subtleties, like subtleties about how you ask the question. Like if you're asking about the dog or a dog. And then English speakers are going to really pick up on that, on the precise wording. Suppose you translate your wording into another language that doesn't even have the or a or a. And I think it could be a very big mess. So cross-culture research is quite difficult. There's this one guy that I skipped. This guy is just doing great work in experimental philosophy. Just for the sake of time, I skipped over his space and whatever. But Edward, he's a big shot and successful and charming, the whole bit. He's the whole package. And he's able to put together massive teams. So right now he has teams of anthropology. He's a philosophy professor. But he's told these anthropologists about what he does in experimental philosophy. And you know, anthropologists go off into the jungle or wherever it is they go. Wait, who's an anthropologist? You were talking about anthropology earlier, yeah? Not an anthropologist, but you were talking about it earlier. And he said, while you're doing your anthropology thing, could you just sort of include my experimental philosophy questionnaires there in Papua New Guinea or wherever you happen to be in the middle of the Pacific or whatever? Yeah. And he's just got people just dozens of people all over the planet working for him. And not only that, he's consulting with linguistic experts and then the anthropologists who know sort of about the culture that can speak to these things. Because you're right, when you sort of want to go between cultures, things could get all lost in translation in all sorts of ways, whether you would never even guess. But he's trying to, but he pulls onto his team people who have expertise in those native languages to help with the wording of the question. So there's a big issue, and it's big issues for psychology as well, but if they were trying to address it.
Yeah.
It reminds me when I was in undergraduate school, I took a course in social psychology, and we went out on the campus and asked questions like this. So why is experimental philosophy different from
that? So most of this is a lot of people don't realize that. I think the average the general public doesn't realize that the way that psychology is divided into different disciplines. So developmental psychology concerned with children, of course clinical psychology concerned with counseling, but social psychology is mostly what this is. Social psychology is just thinking about the social world, thinking about other people. Did that guy do that? Do what he did intentionally? Or does he know what he's talking about? Or does he just merely believe? So you're thinking about what's inside other minds. That is social psychology. The only difference is, it's not a big difference. The debates start, the investigations start from a philosophical debate. And now more and more in social psychology, the social psychologists actually read philosophers first to get some ideas about cool things to work on.
We have time for one more question, anybody?
Yes, Jack.
Well, when I was working at this video game company, we had a sensitivity trainer come in, and she talked about a bunch of stuff, but what I remember, she said, it's a hypothetical, if you're with your boss, he's driving, and you're riding, and he hits somebody, you know, and maybe they're dead, and then he drives away and says, okay, look, don't tell anyone, don't mention this, that should you or do you tell, maybe anonymously? And like 90% said yes. In Italy, it was almost the opposite. They reluctantly said no, you shouldn't. Because we're a society of laws and not men. Italy is about relationships. And you don't betray your boss. It blew everyone's mind.
Yeah, I read Confucius for the first time last fall, and this isn't being recorded, right? I didn't like a word of it, but one of the things that he says in the Analects of Confucius is he relates it to your family. If your dad is the one doing that, Confucius explicitly says, this is like the official sort of ethical teaching of China for centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries, you should lie for your dad. And he didn't say boss, but I guess he thought Confucius would probably say you should lie for your boss too, not China men. And to so many of us, that just sounds crazy. But I'm glad you brought up this cultural difference. Okay, so one thing about experimental philosophy is this. We have regular philosophers talking about what they think is true. And I kind of alluded to this earlier. But professional philosophers who teach as professors, you know, they're an odd bunch. I remember when I was on the job market, my first job was Louisiana State University, LSU, before I got this job in Buffalo, and I remember going to job interviews in New York City and walking around Times Square, and I could pick out the philosophers from 100 yards away. People who are strangers to me. I could figure, because they're not normal. So you have all these sort of not normal people writing about what they think is true, and assuming like that everybody else would agree with them. And okay, one thing about experimental philosophy is you can actually test that. So by the way, experimental philosophy is not going to tell you what you do if you do find cultural variation between us and the Italians or the Chinese or whatever. Okay, experimental philosophy is not going to tell you how to resolve that. But it can at least make you aware, like maybe you were just assuming everybody everywhere is thinking just like you. And then you would do a little empirical study. You run the questionnaire with the video game company amongst the Italians or whatever it is, and you realize not everybody agrees with you. You're like, oh, well. And then it's going to be a cause or a stimulus for greater philosophical reflection on your own part. Like, I still think I'm right, and I still think the Italians are wrong. Suppose you think that. But now I've got to think of a new way to justify myself. Like before, when everybody around me just agreed with me, I didn't really have to think very hard about how to justify myself. But now that I know there's other people who are different, I got to think harder. And so the empirical part can at least bring about greater awareness there.
Thank you. Thank you.